All right, let's go ahead and get started. My name is Jamie Kuhl. With me is Chris Patterson. We are both program managers in the Team Foundation Server org, or TFS as we know and love it. I assume everyone has read the warning label, understands it, and is prepared to move forward. There will be consent forms that will be circulating throughout the audience for you to sign. If anybody has a stroke because they see too much code this talk, I don't want to be the one held responsible.
It's not that much code, people.
Yeah. All right. If you enjoy watching people build an application, you're going to enjoy this talk, because that's what we're going to do. So what are we going to be building that application for? We're going to be building it for this thing called continuous delivery. And what exactly is continuous delivery? Well, really simply, it's just a question of how fast can you take this change that you wrote as a developer and get it into an environment that a customer can consume it in, right? Like, how much can you shorten that down to? And, you know, this notion of continuous delivery is really just one engineering practice in this broader category called DevOps, or developer operations. The notion of DevOps is really just how much can we bring the notion of your development practices and your operations practices together. And this really sprang from all of the momentum that has been coming out of the notion of Agile in the recent years. You know, if you think about the motivations behind the Agile movement, things like, you know, you want to just be able to take your work, break it down, get it done in a small increment, make sure it's totally done, get it out to customers, get their feedback, and iterate, right? That's all great, except, you know, an engineering team, if you move to an Agile practice and, you know, you get to the end of a sprint, and you've built your work, but it still takes you 3 months to get what you built at the end of the sprint out to a customer to actually consume, you're actually not getting as much of the benefits of Agile as you really want. You talk about other benefits in the Agile space or other concepts in the Agile space. One of them is the notion of all of the disciplines in the development team starting to come together. Test and development is another good, is a good example of that, where developers are taking more and more of the responsibility of making sure that the application itself maintains high quality. That's why all of the momentum in unit testing in recent years has come to be. Same thing here in the operations space, where developers are finding a greater need to take more of the responsibility for the actual deployment and operations of the app, not just the construction of it. So if there are any non-developers in the audience that actually aren't going to enjoy writing code and you want to stick around to just watch me make the developers squirm when I tell them they need to get involved in operations, that's totally okay. But that's what we're going to talk about, that notion. And what we're going to do over the course of the next hour and change is go through the process of building an app that's set up for continuous delivery, solves a bunch of the problems for continuous delivery, and then actually turn on continuous delivery. So we're going to be building that app, but before we do it, before we fully bake the cake, I'm going to show you what the end result we're going for is. So let me just switch over. All right. So I'm at my Azure portal, and I've got an Azure website, and I'm just going to go down, and I'm going to click a link to run the application. And the app that we're going to build is a really simple list application, right? Like, we've all seen these 100 times. This is a good one, though, because it has enough of the complexity that we're going to have to solve to really make continuous deployment work without a bunch of other noise getting in the way. And it has just a few basic features like you would expect. I can add tasks like do the demo and verify the demo works. And just in case, if anything goes wrong, kill Chris. And hopefully by the end of the talk, we'll be able to check off at least a couple of these. And for Chris's sake, hopefully we'll be able to delete the last one.
We'll see.
So that's the app, right? Now, the app is good, it works, but Chris, I think there's one thing wrong with this application.
I don't know, it looks great to me.
You know, developers have told us very clearly that the single most important thing to them that they're looking for is color.
That's the perfect color. Come on, it's gray with a little tiny bit of blue.
I don't know.
Does it look familiar to anybody?
I don't know, but it's a little plain, so we're going to add some color to it.
Actually, I think the biggest problem is that title bar is upper and lowercase. I think it needs to be all uppercase.
No, right? Chris, that's just out of bounds.
Oh, come
now,
on.
All right? That's just out of bounds. All right, so we're going to add some color. And as a Virginia Tech graduate, do we have any in the room? Yeah, all right. Everything looks better if you add a little maroon and orange, am I right? So we'll go in here, and we could use the fancy, dancy new 2012 color picker. Have you seen that? That's kind of cool. But we're just going to put maroon in here, and then we'll go down a little lower and change this, and we'll make this orange.
Get rid of the pound.
I forgot the pound. You guys, you need to pay attention, right? Like, if you see problems with what we're doing, I won't need the help, but Chris, he's going to need some help. So
hair coding is important.
Pay attention. All right, so let's just see what this looks like. Okay, and clearly, we have a much better looking application.
The Carolina blue is still there, though, so.
No. The Carolina, okay, we'll fix that one later, Chris. So it looks better, but you notice the data set's different. It's not those tasks that I just entered, and the URL is localhost, right? This is the one running on my local dev box. So now the question is, I've made this change. What's it take to get it up and running in my actual Azure environment? So the first thing I'm going to do is go over to Team Explorer, and we will go to pending changes. And we've got one change here to check in. And we will put a comment, made it way better. To do, fix the ugly blue. All right, so then we'll check it in. So now I'm checking this into source control. And the question is, what's the next step that I've got to do to get this change out to that environment? And the answer is nothing. That's it. It's going to proceed itself. Everything else at this point on is automated. So if we switch over to our build view, we can see that at the top of the list, there's this build that has just been queued. Now, the build's been queued because I have a CI build set up that's listening for changes, for any changes that I commit to that solution. So whenever I do a check-in, it kicks off a CI build. That build will then proceed to do the actual building of the binaries like you would expect. It's a web application, so it's going to produce a web deploy package as part of doing the actual build. It's going to run tests, any tests that are part of it. So if we go over and look at the solution, we can see that there are tests in this application. In fact, I think there's going to be two sets of tests. Yeah,
there actually are. There's both MS test tests and XUnit tests.
Right.
So we'll talk a little bit more about that later.
So if we drill into the build details, we can actually watch the process go through. And, you know, so it'll do our build the package, run the tests, and then deploy it to Azure. So Azure supports multiple types of publishing endpoints. One of those publishing endpoints is web deploy, which is what we're using to actually push the bits out to it. So we're going to talk a lot about all the different technology choices we made as part of building this application. But effectively, what we're using for this talk today is we're using the new version of Visual Studio 2012, the RC candidate. We're using the TFS hosted service, and actually, if you guys want to play around with it, as of yesterday, it's now publicly available to everyone. You just go to tfspreview.com and click Get Started for free, sign up, create your account, and you can use that environment. The only other thing that we're using is an Azure environment for the deployment of this application, and you can go sign up at windowsazure.com and get your own account for that as well if you don't have one already. So all of that's proceeding through. You can see it's run our tests, and it's associating work items. Soon it'll be doing the deployment. Now, the ironic thing here is that if I were to tell you the total time that it's going to take from when I do a check-in to when you see this running in your actual environment is about 2 minutes, that's amazing, right? Like, that's a really fast amount of time. Unless you're the guy standing up on stage waiting for it to finish as part of a demo, then 2 minutes is an exorbitantly long amount of time. But we can see here that it ran the tests. Now it just published the output using MS Deploy, and it has essentially finished. So if we were to go over to our page, and all I'm going to do is click one button, F5, to refresh it.
It's done.
It's done. I can see I have my change showing up in production. Now, you probably have some questions, like, what are all the details of actually making that happen? And what about non-trivial problems like the schema change in your database, and you need to deal with that migration? Those are all good questions, and those are the types of questions that we're going to answer throughout the course of the next hour. All right, so effectively what we're going to do is we're going to build that app from empty application to that continuous delivery state that we just talked about. And of course, when I say we're going to build the application, I mean Chris will be building the application. Along the way, we're going to talk about the core technology choices that we made, right? We're going to have to make decisions. What are we using for data? What are we using for tests? How are we deploying it? There are really no absolute right or wrong answers to these questions. There are advantages and disadvantages to what you choose. We're going to tell you what we chose and why we chose it and the trade-offs involved with that. We'll talk about some of the harder problems like the data migration one that we also talked about. We're also going to try to do two things as we go through this talk. We're going to try to talk about technology. I mean, you've got two geeks from Microsoft up here. You're going to get tons of technology throughout the course of the next hour. But we're also going to try to talk about processes and some of the intrinsics that you need to really make continuous delivery work in the real world. One of them is keeping your quality high with testing. If you can't do that, you're not going to succeed in this space. We'll also talk about application lifecycle challenges. You know, how to set up environments. Should I set up an environment where the dev checks in and all of a sudden it's deployed to production? You can if you want. I probably wouldn't recommend that. So there's different trade-offs in terms of how you manage your branches and your test and production environments in this world. And then we'll go through what it actually takes to get this thing going through the automation pipeline. Finally, we're not really going to talk about operations in this talk. In fact, in a lot of ways, you could call this a no-ops talk. It's all about kind of the developer, them getting the application ready for continuous deployment and them running the deployment. As your application gets bigger and more successful, there's certainly going to be operation folks that are going to get involved. And what you do, what we show you in this talk will make it very easy for you to grow up and have a very seamless relationship with your ops team. There's actually another talk right after this one that goes into more of the operation side of the world in this DevOps space, if you're interested in that. All right, so let's jump into the actual building of the app. Now, to do this, we need to make a couple of technology choices up front. So should we do this on-premise in the private cloud or in the public cloud? I'm not going to go through the pros and cons of that. You guys probably already understand that real well, especially for your own environment, or you know, you're probably wrestling with that question now yourself. For us, we went with the public cloud as much because we didn't want to carry the private cloud with us. So of course, because we went with public cloud, we picked Windows Azure. Now, in terms of the technologies that I'm going to show you, our goal and direction is to make all of this stuff work as seamlessly in both the private and the public cloud. There are some trade-offs today in terms of some things work better in some scenarios than others, and we'll point those out along the way. But the direction is consistency. Once we picked Azure, we actually needed to pick the type of application we were going to deploy to Azure, because as of now, Azure actually supports three types. If you've used Azure in the past, you're familiar with what they call the cloud services. And so these are web roles, worker roles. If you build an application with Azure, you get that environment. This is what we use in the hosted TFS service ourselves. It's very powerful, lots of control. You get a lot of benefits in terms of scale, in terms of how you manage your load and scaling out. There is a bit of a learning curve to get into that, though. As of last Thursday, Azure supports two other scenarios really well. One is a pure infrastructure as a service, so we could have just set up VMs and be deploying to those VMs running on Azure. The other one, though, and this is the one that we're using, is the Windows Azure website. And the Windows Azure websites are just very lightweight hosts for running your web applications in Azure. They're multi-tenant, which means they're running side-by-side in an isolated manner with other applications, but that means they're dirt cheap, right? They're really lightweight, they're really simple to get deployed, and you can turn the dial and scale them as you need. So they fit really well with the type of app we were trying to do here. So that's kind of the baseline. And then we had one more question to answer, which is application stack, which do we use? And Chris and I had a long debate about whether we should use Node or PHP. And then we kind of had this realization, maybe we should use ASP.NET for this talk, I don't know. It's actually not as crazy a conversation as it would sound like because, again, as of now, Azure supports other non-traditional Microsoft platforms really well. But we're going to be using ASP.NET, and even when we say we're using ASP.NET, even there's a number of choices we could have used. And we're going to be using MVC4 and Web API for our application. And Chris will talk a little bit about the advantages of those technologies as we go through. So I'm going to hand it off to Chris, and let's start building the app that we're going to use for continuous delivery.
Okay, so now on to the actual technology side. As Jamie mentioned, we're building this task list app you saw, and I put a couple of key requirements in place when I was building it. First, I have to have something that I can change. I can deploy quickly to Azure. So I needed a technology that would do that. Also, I want to have a website, and I want to have an API, something that I could write other clients against. So to do that, I'm going to kind of start on the back end. And what I have here is essentially an empty application. Basically, I did file new project, and I dropped in a little bit of HTML for my views because I don't really want to write HTML on stage. And I also have a small JavaScript file that I wrote that has a little bit of logic in it. So when we talk about building modern services-based applications, one of the more popular ways people are building those apps really are these web-based or REST APIs. And to do that, there's a number of ways you could accomplish that. You could make it work with Azimex Web Services or just straight MVC actions. With ASP.NET MVC 4, or I guess ASP.NET 4, we introduced this new concept of API controllers. And what those are is they're built on an underlying technology called Web API, and they really are designed to make it easy for you to build these REST APIs. And to show you that, I'm going to start out by just creating a very basic tasks controller. And because I'm returning tasks, I want to have a little bit of a model here. So we're just going to have a simple task object. And it's going to have three properties to start with. So we'll do an ID property, a title property, and a Boolean property for the completion, so is done. All right? Very simple model, nothing exciting there. However, we need to get that model back to our clients, and we want to do it in a very easy way. So to do that, I'm going to simply return an enumerable of my task objects. We're just going to call this get tasks, right? And simply return a new list of task objects, and then we'll initialize it with some tasks. ID equals one, title, my task is done, true. And then let's do a second one just so it's not lonely in the list. ID equals, oops, two, title, my other task is done, equals false this time. If I could spell, there we go. All right, do we compile? All right, we compiled, our unit tests ran, we're in good shape. All right, let's load this guy up in the browser and take a look at it. So we pull up our site again, and we actually see that our website is populated with those couple of tasks. But what's really interesting is kind of what's going on under the covers. So let's pull up, just go and hit this API endpoint. So we're using routing with a web API, so our endpoint for our tasks resource is /API/tasks. And we can see that it's actually going to download a file for us. And what this is the data coming from our server side being serialized as JSON coming across the wire. Now, if I open up, let's say, another browser, let's use Chrome this time, and we do the same thing, we'll see that we get back a different representation. In this case, we got back an XML representation. Now, the reason for that is because Web API is doing a lot of nice things for us. And as I mentioned, I want to have multiple clients, and I want to have the ability to let those clients work in ways that make sense for them. So, instead of me having to go sort of re-implement everything, I can simply implement my API how I want to, and then let the client request the type of format that it wants, and let the pipeline take care of serializing and deserializing those objects for me. So that's one of the really nice new features that makes it much easier to build these sort of more modern applications with ASP.NET. So there's just a little bit of the ASP.NET Web API technology. And there will be another talk that we'll mention later on if you want to learn more about that. But one of the other key aspects of Web API and the way it's implemented is this idea of convention over configuration. Now, my application requested, performed an HTTP GET. I simply named the method on my controller GET tasks, and the runtime took care of the rest for me. In fact, if I go in and I add some additional stuff, so we're going to add more stuff to our task controller, and then we'll do one other quick drop in here for a repository, a place to get our tasks. We'll talk about this in a second, so we'll call this our task repository. Did I spell that right? Okay. And then we'll, just so you don't have to watch me type too much code, since I've already been told that I'm typing too much.
What do you mean, Chris?
Yeah, well, you know. So we'll drop in a task repository, and a repository here is really just a pattern. It's a way of decoupling the persistence knowledge from our application logic, in this case our controller. So we're going to make use of that repository here.
I think that's a really good point, right? Like the decoupling was the key word, right? Like, so maybe you're wondering, why are we going deep into this in a continuous delivery talk? One of the reasons why we're doing that is that we're going to talk about keeping your code quality high, because that's going to be one of the absolute keys for you to be successful in continuous delivery. One of the keys in doing that is making sure that your code is eminently testable. One of the ways you do that is making it so it's very decoupled, following these modern practices. So this is why we're starting with this as our base.
Oops. So one more quick bit of code here. We'll delete that and just simply return our tasks, repo.get all. And because I'm returning an iQueryable, I need to make sure I return it as an enumerable. All right. OK, so let's see if we have something that's fully functioning yet. All right, we have our two tasks returning. If I go, say, we're going to add more tasks. That seemed to work. If we look here down at the bottom, we see that that one actually went across as a post. I could delete one. It's going to go across as an HTTP delete. I could then, of course, do an update, and it's going to go across as a put. And the reason that all worked is, again, that idea of convention over configuration. So I've separated my concerns and my persistence. I've let the runtime do the work for me, so I don't have the potential of getting some XML configuration file wrong in one environment versus another, which brings down the whole system. So I'm really just relying on, again, this idea of separation concerns, convention over configuration to make it easier for me to develop my app to keep that quality high, which we'll talk more about later on. So I think we're good, right?
You got a good app? We're ready to deploy it?
I think so.
But aren't you missing kind of an important thing?
No. I think it's ready to go.
How are you saving the data?
It's saving. It's in memory.
So basically,
it's a high availability web server. It's never going down, right?
So you just have to finish the task before the process gets done?
That's the idea.
All right. I don't think so. So let's talk about this question of data. All right. So almost every application needs to use data. Data is actually a very interesting question when you start talking about continuous delivery, because your data changes from release to release. You need to add, remove fields. You already have a huge set of existing data. It needs to get migrated and transformed to the new one. So what should you do? Well, again, there's not really any right or wrong answer here, but there are different trade-offs you make along the way. If we're talking about the ASP.NET stack, you know, the primary primary data technologies are around the entity framework, right? Now, even in the entity framework, when you talk about what do I want to do, how do I want to program it, there's two fundamental models. There's the designer-centric view, which we started out with, where you start by designing your database. You know, you drag the tables on, you add your fields, you link up your relationship, and then that'll generate your code that you program against. That's one model. And then there's the code-first model. And the code-first model is about, I just define the shape of my data with just normal CLR classes. And then from that, the entity framework can derive what your database should be. And there's ways to control and customize that, but there are these two very different models that you can work. And it really depends on which mode you prefer to operate on. And from that perspective, it's not really important what you pick for continuous delivery. What is important is when you talk about the deployment and migration aspect, right? And there are two different models. So if you choose the designer-centric way, you're talking about the SQL Server data tools. You're probably going to be best off using DACPACs to do deployment. If you're not familiar with DACPACs, essentially they're representations of your database schema. You can feed them into a SQL Server, and it can instantiate a database based on that schema. You can feed it into an existing one, and it can dynamically figure out what the changes are between the two and do the migration for you automatically. So it's very powerful. You can represent anything you want in a DACPAC. It is a little bit of black box. You know, you're basically feeding in this definition and trusting it to do this and trusting it to figure out what the right deltas are as part of it. But that's what's going to work the best if you're talking about the designer-centric worldview. If you're talking about the code-first view, there's another model that's fairly new called Entity Framework Migrations. And Entity Framework Migrations works a little different. It works on the premise of having an up and a down script, right? Like, here's the script to run when I want to go up a version. Here's the script to run when I want to go down a version, right? And that's a pretty easy concept to understand, because if you've been doing the migration yourself with scripts, you've probably essentially been doing this in some form already. What the Entity Framework Code First stuff does is help you maintain those scripts. So it's got a model around versioning those scripts, making sure the right migration scripts are run to take the database to the version that your application needs, helping you actually author the migration scripts while you're writing your code, basically looking at your classes and saying, okay, to incorporate all the changes he's made since the last time he did a migration, this would be the script that it would be. But then you can see the script, and it's strongly typed, it's CLR code, manage, you know, change it, customize it, do whatever you want, run it yourself, verify that it works. So there's a lot of advantages from that standpoint. The limitations are that you can't capture everything with an Entity Framework migration. You can't, for example, deploy a Sprock to your database if you want to. But again, if you're doing a code-first type of data model, you probably don't have Sprocks anyway. So they go hand in hand. So if you're doing the code-first model, you're probably going to want to use the Entity Framework migration. So because Chris has essentially already defined his data as CLR classes for what he wants to be when he defined that task, we've already started down the code-first model. So we're going to keep going down that, and we're going to use code-first for our data and Entity Framework migrations to solve our migration problems. All right? Let's add some data, Chris.
I'll switch over. Okay, so data. It's always a tough conversation to have, because you have lots of organizations that have existing databases. Not often are you able to do a lot of greenfield stuff. Luckily, we are in this case, so it makes it easy. But even with the code-first model, you can use it against existing databases, so it lets you kind of define that object relational mapping. However, the key secondary aspect is not just defining the mapping between, you know, how to persist this object to the database, but also how do I deploy the database, and how do I revision the database with the right schema. So to do that with Entity Framework in this case, I've got my model, my very, very simple task model, and all I need to do is tell Entity Framework about my mapping. So in this case, I'm going to create a task list context. And this is simply going to be a class that derives from DB context, which is the root object for Entity Framework that all database operations go through. And then I simply need to add a property to this that is of type DB set for my tasks. And we'll call this just tasks. And so at this point, I define the mapping. That's really all I need to do to define that, hey, I have an object, I want to persist it to the database. The next thing I need to do is I need to define where the database is that I want to persist to, and then I can define how I want to actually deploy this schema. So to define where my database is, I'm going to really simply just create a constructor here and have it call the base type, and I'm going to pass just a connection string name. All right, so that's just the name of a connection string. If we take a quick look in my web config file, it's right there. It's a pretty standard connection string. In this case, it's talking to the new local DB, which is a new lightweight SQL instance that's part of Visual Studio 2012. So it also worked fine with SQL Express or a regular SQL Server.
So one of the problems you're going to have to solve when we talk about continuous delivery is you want it to run against the local one here.
Yep.
But when you actually check in and get it deployed, you're going to want to switch it over to talk about to go to one in Azure, right?
That's true.
Yep.
So we'll have to solve that later. All right, so I've defined my mapping, defined the overall context for my database. I've defined where it's going to go. Now I have to actually go ahead and tell it, how do we deploy the data? And to do that with Entity Framework migrations, the team who builds Entity Framework has provided us with some nice commands, some nice automation to do that. And they run that automation as PowerShell commandlets. This right now is the Package Manager console, which installs in Visual Studio as part of NuGet. And primarily it's about installing and uninstalling and updating dependencies, but it also allows us to add some really great automation to Visual Studio. So first thing I'm going to do is call enable migrations. And that is a commandlet that will go through, check up to see if there are any context that exists. If not, it will go ahead and create this new configuration class for us. And this configuration class gives us that sort of first line of control over how our database is set up. And there's a number of things we can do here. The primary thing we're doing is we just want automatic migration set up. We could then look for other properties. There's a variety of other things. You can control how code is generating. You can set up particular different assemblies. There's lots of different things you can do here. But for now, we're going to ignore that. There's another deeper talk on Entity Frameworks, which will go into that. And once I've enabled migrations, all I really need to do is add a migration. And so I'm just going to call add migration initial. And what it's going to do is it's going to look at that context that I've defined. It's going to compare it to an existing version that it knows about, in which case there is no existing version. So I'm going to get everything new. It's going to set up a nice function that's going to use code, so nice code mapping to describe what my table needs to look like. Again, for developers, for somebody who really wants to work more in code, this is a great option. You don't have to deal with SQL. You don't have to deal with some of the issues there. It's also going to use some nice, again, conventions to say, hey, what is the shape of this table? In my case, there's a field called ID on my class, so it's going to assume that's going to be the primary key. I could, of course, change that. And once you've done that, all you need to do to go ahead and test this locally is just tell Entity Framework that you want to go ahead and run the migrations against your local database. So I'm calling update database. It's going to run against my local database. And then if I go take a look here, we have our task table with all of our options. And it's really pretty much that simple. You can actually use these commandlets to target remote databases if you want to, but in our case, we'll take a look at how to make that work as part of our continuous deployment later. Once I have my database deployed, my context defined, I need to obviously go ahead and use it. So to, again, kind of move things along a little bit, I'm going to create another repository, again, following our repository pattern. And we're going to call this our DB task repository. And one of the things that I'm starting to think about now is, well, so now I have two implementations of this repository. And that's potentially problematic, right? They might change. I might have more methods. So what I want to do is I want to do a little bit of refactoring to kind of keep this separation of concerns and allow for some better testability later on. So what I'm going to do here is I'm going to extract an interface out of my task repository. Let's call it iTask repository. We want to make this a public interface. And then I'm going to, let's go ahead and refactor this guy to our memory task repository. Okay, should be good. And then we're going to go to our database task repository and simply implement iTask repository. T-O-R-Y, right? Yep, there. Okay, and so you don't have to watch me actually go through and implement everything. Oops, got too many curly braces. Let's try this again. Now we need the checker extra, whoops, extra equals. Okay. So everything builds. We have our new database task repository. We can go through this very quickly. You know, we're just newing up one of our contexts, and then we have the same methods that we had on our interface, where we're calling the appropriate methods on our context. And to make sure we can use this, we're going to go to our task controller. And just for now, we're going to replace this. We're going to rename this guy to be just an iTask repository. And for the moment, we will replace this with the DB task repository. We'll build it again. That looks good. Let's make sure it's running. All right, so we got nothing back, which means there's probably no data. So if we add one, that seems to work. There we go. We can try to save it. Nope, seems to be working. So now we've gone from an API that was talking to this list in memory. We've used some nice technology from Entity Framework to allow to take our same model and persist it to a database. We've moved that database forward from nothing to having the schema deployed in a method that will let us continue to do that as we add new capabilities and new features to our application. So I think that's it.
So you got a working app. You're ready to deploy it.
Sure, why not?
I have one concern, Chris.
What's that?
It's working now, but how do I know you're not going to break it in the future? Because PMs love to add features. Just to give you a little insight into the inner workings of Microsoft, right? We have the dev and test team. They build the things. And the PMs, we're supposed to be the customer representative. So we're out there. We're in the dev teams. We're pushing. You guys want features. We're pushing to get new features in, right? Like, even if it breaks everything else, like, we're just pushing on it. And the rest of the team keeps us in check. But which are you? Are you a PM or a dev, Chris?
I play a dev on TV.
Yeah, so but you're a PM. So we need some way to make sure you're not going to break it. So let's talk a little bit about tests. So I've alluded to this before, but one of the most important things, technology aside, to make continuous delivery work is you got to keep the quality up. Like, we can show you how to get all this set up. You can get it set up for your app where you check in, it goes through the whole continuous delivery flow. But if the next check-in happens and it's just broken when it gets deployed, you didn't gain any benefit. You have to have a way to really keep your quality high. And in my 14 years now at Microsoft and all the teams I've worked in, generally speaking, I found teams fall in two categories. Either the builds always work and the quality's high, right, and it's a rare day that things are down, or you get a good build every 3 weeks, right? And if you're on the side where you get a good build every 3 weeks, then continuous delivery is not going to work for you. You got to figure out how to get your quality high first, then talk about getting the continuous delivery. So in that context, we actually have a bunch of new support this release in the test side of things. Well, you can use pretty much any test framework that you want for unit tests inside of Visual Studio now. I think we're going to be using MS Test and XUnit.
Yeah.
But we could use NUnit or, you know, really a variety of others. It's got an extensible model. So there's a lot of technology there for it, but it's not just about writing the test, because if you have an application that has, I've had this happen too, you know, you've got an application, especially an old legacy one, and it's got really low quality, and you put the tests around it, but they just keep breaking, and now you just have a lot of tests that keep breaking all the time anyway, because you can't keep the quality of the thing high. You know, it really also starts with having good architecture. And, you know, I'm not going to stand up here and pretend in this talk that we can tell you how to build an application that has good architecture. Probably most of you know how to build an application that has good architecture already. But it's an important thing. And it doesn't mean, you know, hey, get a high-level design document, get everything architected perfectly from the day one. No. I mean, you can evolve it and as you go, but you have to think about this if you want to do continuous delivery. And probably one of the biggest fundamental things is around isolation, right? Like good patterns like dependency injection and version of control. If you don't know what those concepts are, it's fine. Don't worry about it. Go research it, look it up. These are good things to try and learn. But they all fall in the same category, which is about trying to isolate different things so that when you are ready to test, you can test what you actually want to test as it was meant to work without other dependencies, you know, making the test brittle or making the test unreliable. We also have more technology in this release to help you do that. We have a fakes framework that has support for Stubs and shims.
Stubs and shims, yeah.
If you don't know what all of these those words are either, again, don't worry about it. We'll point you at a talk later that's going to go into that in more depth. But in a nutshell, what it is if you have a system made up of various sets of parts, and you want to test this one, and you want to provide just enough of the other part of the system into what you're trying to test in a controlled way with a particular kind of setup, there's a framework that helps you do that without having to re-implement everything just to have a unit to test with, right? And that's where Stubs come into play. And I think, Chris, you're going to show us how you can put some tests in here so that even I couldn't break the system, right?
Sure. Okay, so as Jamie mentioned, quality, if you're even going to attempt to deliver regularly, is job one. And it's everybody's job one. You cannot rely on somebody else to put quality in your code as a developer. You have got to test it. You are the primary tester of your code. Now, in order to do that, I think you need a couple of things. Number one is you have to have confidence in your tests, but also you have to be comfortable writing tests. And comfortable writing tests can mean a couple of things. One of them might be you've just done it a lot, so you get good at it. The other one is you get to use a framework that makes you feel comfortable. Certainly with the last two versions of Visual Studio, there has been a unit testing framework in there. It does some things very well and some things not so well. But everybody has their favorites. So we've worked very hard to allow you to make that choice. So we're going to create a new, just plain old class library. And I'm going to call it tasklist.xunittests. And as you can see, I already have a few unit tests here. In fact, these are MS test tests. So you can recognize that by the test method attribute there. But for these tests, I want them to be using the XUnit framework because I happen to like it. So we give our test class a nice name. And then we simply need to do a couple of things to be ready to run this. First thing we did is in the Visual Studio gallery, I installed this XUnit runner. This is part of the new extensibility. It's available for free on the gallery. And there's ones for NUnit and QUnit and MBUnit, and some other ones are coming along. Secondly, of course, I need to actually get the XUnit framework into my project. And I can do that in a couple of ways. I could go find it, download it, unzip it, or I could just simply use NuGet. So I can open the NuGet package manager, search for XUnit, and I find the XUnit framework, and just click on install, and it's going to download all of the dependencies for me and install them into my project. In fact, I'm going to need a couple of more here. Since I am testing this web API app, in order to test it, I need to have a little bit of infrastructure. So I want to make sure I have all of the web API classes. The really nice thing here is these classes are totally separate from the actual, from IIS. They're not related to it. So I can do this whole thing without necessarily spinning up an HTTP server, which is pretty nice. And again, just overall makes it more testable. So I've added my references. And then finally, I've got to do one more quick thing, which is, of course, I need a reference to my task list library. And give me one more from system.web. OK. So my project is now all set up to let me run my unit test and or create my unit test. So what I want to do here is I'm going to write one of the probably the key kind of unit test that I like to start with, and that is one that does behavioral verification. In this case, I'm going to define this as a test, and for XUnit, I do that with the fact attribute. Do a public void, and I'm going to say post should return HTTP created. So this is making a statement about the behavior, not necessarily the implementation, but just the behavior of the post method for my task controller. And for now, I'm just going to say, just assert true, just to kind of get things going here. Make sure I can build my test, see it get pickup, and it ran. So we can see over here in the test window, I've got two different test frameworks running, and they're all working happily. Now, to test this controller, if we go ahead and go over and take a look at our task controller, we need to decide what we need. So first off, we have the controller. It's got a repository. And we see that this post method, which we're going to test, actually calls that repository. And as I mentioned, in this case, I'm not so interested in the fact that the repository is saving to the database, because this is really about the behavior of this particular thing, and I think that's important. So what I want to do is I'm going to give myself the ability to actually just give the task controller a repository at creation time. And this, by doing this, it gets me the ability to set up another pattern, which would be dependency injection, which is another important capability, again, for allowing your application to be testable, easily deployable, and task controller. Thank you so much. I told you pair programming would come in handy at some
point. I told
you
he was going to need help.
Anyway, so this is setting me up for a pattern called dependency injection, or inversion of control, kind of related. But basically, I want to tell this task controller, hey, here's the repo I want you to use. And to do that, what I want to do is, I don't want to give it a real repo, I just want to give it a fake one, because again, it's just about the behavior. So what I'm going to do is right-click on my task list library there, and say add fakes assembly. And Visual Studio is going to go through and create a stub or fake implementation of all of the extendable public classes in my project. So now, if I open this guy up, I can see there's a bunch of information here, all these shims and stubs. Again, I'm not going to go into a huge amount of detail other than they exist and show you how to use them, but there's a better unit testing talk later on that will go into more details. So let's go ahead and write our test. So first thing we're going to need is we're going to need a task, because we need a post one. So we'll just do that, new task, do that, and then initialize it, ID, 0, title is task, and is done is false, it's fine. All right, so that's all set up. And then the next thing we're going to need is we're going to need a stub implementation of our repository to pass to our controller. So to do that, I'm going to create a repository and make it equal to a new, so we'll just dig through our namespaces here. It's task list dot, it's in our models dot fakes. So this is a new namespace that's been added dot stub I task repository. And we'll set that up. And this becomes a very interesting object, because it really is just a, it's completely null of implementation, and I actually get to provide the implementation here. And what I'm going to do is simply say, when save or update task is called, I want to take the task parameter and just set it equal to new task equals task. Okay? It's a lambda. We don't need to go into a lot of detail, but all this is really saying is, hey, when I call save or update task, return me this object. Because, again, it's just about the behavior.
Basically, all you did was a shorthand for implementing the interface for the part you needed.
Exactly. So I didn't have to implement multiple pieces of it right now. And then I'm going to create my controller. Now, because I've got...
You're missing a P.
Yeah, I'm missing a P. We'll get there. Because I'm using Web API, there are a couple of things I need to kind of set this up, and this code is, it looks crazy, but it's really not that bad. The nice idea here is I'm using the Web API framework, but I'm not actually running IIS or anything like that. Whoops. So it lets me create unit tests and run unit tests inside environments where I may not actually have a web server or need to deploy the web server. So that's really kind of a big advantage. So anyway, so we're going to code our tasks controller. We're going to set up controller, pass it the repository, and then check the return. HTTP response message response equals controller dot post. And we're going to post our new task. And then we're going to check that equal, that the response code, so HTTP status TUS code, is the same. So we're looking for the created status code and then response.status code. Okay? And if I did my job right, we should now have another unit test that's building and running. And this won't take a, there it goes. So it's all run, and it's still passing. Right? So we've taken what was kind of a nothing unit test, and we're verifying some behavior against something that could be fairly complex, but we're doing a nice separation of the behavior versus the implementation. And that's what we're really trying to verify here. So I could add more unit tests, but for the sake of time, we're going to kind of push on to showing what this thing looks like running.
All right. So essentially now we've met the requirements of continuous delivery. Right? We have our app. It's architected well. You get our tests. We're going to keep it at high quality. Right. So now we want to actually talk about the workflow of getting this into continuous delivery. So first, we're going to need a source control system. So we're from the TFS team, so we thought, hey, TFS would be a great choice for this. But even there, you get to choose the server on-premise or the service in the cloud. Both are available. You can download the RC and install it on-premise. You can sign up for the service and be gone in about 30 seconds. The other thing that we're going to need is we need the automation engine, right? Like, we need the automation engine to run the actual, the build, the test, the deploy part of the flow. So we're using our build system for this, which is built on Windows Workflow, so it is really just an automation engine. We're, again, doing all of this in the cloud, and we're doing that with a feature called Cloud Build. So it's in, with our hosted service, we have a pool of build machines running out there in the cloud. So when you kick off a build, it basically sends a request. We find a build machine from the pool, assign it to go do that build, let it execute the build, clean it up, put it back in the pool. And this is a really nice feature because it means that we can really commoditize the cost of builds, right? Like, I'm willing to bet everybody out there has build machines, and I'm also willing to bet you don't have your build machine using 100% of its cycles, right? Maybe you do if you have rolling builds set up, but there's a lot of extra time being wasted. Well, if you're sharing that across, you know, a group of people, the cost, total cost of doing the builds go way down. So we're going to take advantage of that. And then, you know, because it is a generic automation engine, you can do this continuous delivery scenario with this in any environment that you want, an on-premise TFS to an on-premise targeted web server, an on-premise TFS to a cloud service, be it Azure or something else. What we're working to do now is raise the level, is lower the degree of difficulty it takes to get that configured. So the first scenario that we picked was the TFS hosted service to Azure. So we've created a customized build definition and made the wiring up of that a very simple process. So take the output of a build that's produced and get that deployed over to Azure. And then we'll be doing that for, you know, a broader set of scenarios as we move forward, but this is the first one, and that's what we're going to show you today. Now, I talked before about branches, right? And this is something that you should think about because some of you may be sitting there thinking, you know, this continuous delivery thing, am I going to have my devs really take what they check in and have it go out to production right away? You're probably not going to want to do that. What you're going to want to do is set up a dev branch where your devs do the work, have a matching environment for that that you've got continuous delivery set up for. And you know, when I say continuous delivery, you can do it at whatever rate makes sense for you. You could have it on every check-in. We support batch, you know, builds. You could do it in batches. You could have it set up so that every night it builds everything that was done that day, deploys it, and when everybody comes in the morning, they have kind of a working environment that they can see where they're at. You could do it manual, so only when you push a button do you want it to actually go through this. A good time to go do that is if you have a main branch that's set up that's mapped to your production environment, and you want that deployment to go through the same pipeline, but you want to explicitly control when you actually do that. You can make that be a manual process. So generally, you can set this up with whatever topology you want. You could have, you know, dev environments and pre-production environments and your production environments or whatever you want to go do. Generally, the closer you are to the lower down in the stack you are, the closer to the actual dev changes, the more aggressive you can be in terms of pushing out the updates. So, Chris, bring us home. Let's see this thing.
Okay. All right, so we've built our app. We've got our unit tests running. Now let's get it someplace where we can deploy it. And what I'm going to do is just simply, I'm connected up. I've got an account on the TFS preview service. So I'm just going to right-click and add my solution to source control. Yep. Okay. And go here, and I can look at my pending changes. And you know, this is the first time that I've done this where I had the same number of files twice in a row. I'm not sure what I'm doing differently, but I'll have to figure that out one of these days.
It's not a high confidence thing.
Yeah,
in terms of working.
It's true. So anyway, I'm just going to do a check-in, give it a comment, call it initial. And while this is uploading to the cloud, we have a couple of other things to deal with.
Asynchronously uploading
to
the cloud.
So Visual Studio is still running. So anybody who's used TFS and dealt with check-ins and modal dialogues, that's all gone now, which is kind of nice. So there's another key thing that we mentioned before, which is that I'm running my app. I have a database, but it's local. My connection string is local. How am I actually going to get this pointed at the right environment, the right connection string when it's in the cloud? And so with inside my Windows Azure portal here for my website, there is this download publish profile. And this will simply give me a file that I can just save to my disk that's got a lot of that information in it. And when I go, so you can see our check-in's done. When I go over to my project, I'm going to click on this little publish dialog and import that publish profile. And it's going to pull some settings out of it. And the key setting that I really want is this connection string. And I want to tell it to apply code-first migrations on application start. So I want my database to deploy when my application starts. And we're just going to close this out. We don't need to publish from Visual Studio, but we just need this publish profile. So at build time, we can do the right thing. In this case, we're going to say, okay, added publish profile. And we're going to check it in. All right. So that's going to check in those three items. All right. So we have our code checked in. We've got our publish profile set up. The next thing we need to do is we need to make TFS aware that where it's going to publish. So to do that, we've worked hard with the Azure team to make this as simple as possible. You'll see there's a nice link here that says set up TFS publishing. If I click on that, I just have to provide a couple of pieces of information. The first one being the account, my TFS preview account. And I'll click authorize now. And this is going to walk me through a sort of standard OAuth exchange that says, yep, I'm going to allow Azure to talk to my TFS account. And then Azure is going to use that information to query back and say, hey, which project would you like to publish from? So in this case, I'm going to pick my task list project, click the OK, the checkbox button. And Azure is going to go through and do a couple of things. It's going to give TFS a certificate so we can talk back to Azure. And it's going to set up a build definition in my project for me. So if I go look at builds, I now have this continuous integration build that's been configured by Azure that knows how to deploy to Windows Azure. So we see it's sort of mapped my solution. It's set up as continuous integration. If I go look at the process, it is found my task list solution. And the last thing that I need to do is I need to tell it about my publish profile. So we're going to go through and find that publish profile that we checked in. In case we want the web deploy one.
And really what this is just doing is saying,
yeah,
when this CI build builds,
mm-hmm,
the information in that publish profile about the database on Azure, that's the information to use when,
yep,
it deploys it.
And so it's going to do a web config transform for me. And if I've done everything right, I can queue a build. And this will go from, to show you there's nothing there. So let's go back to our dashboard here. Bring up our website. So our website's not published yet. There's nothing there. So this is going to build my application, do everything that we saw in the first demo, run my tests, and then push this over to Azure. So given that takes a couple of minutes, what I'm going to do is I'm going to see if I can add a new feature to this application right now. So let's go, and one of the things that
So you haven't even finished deploying the first one, and you're already working on the new features?
Well, I know it's going to go. It's going to be automated. I'll just work on the next feature. One of the things that's driving me a little nuts, especially as a program manager, is there's no priorities on these tasks. I mean, I can't very well get things done or get things done in the order I want if there's no priority. So I'm going to add that here. And the first thing I need to do is I just need to add it to my model. And then I need to tell my database about it, right? So I'm going to run add migration again. So we'll add migration.
So that's going to generate a new version of that migration script.
Yep. See, now I have a new version of the migration script with just one field in it this time. And then, of course, I'm going to update my local database.
So when's that migration script going to get run?
So that one just got run right now against my local database.
All right.
When I deploy to Azure, it's actually going to get run when the application starts up. All right.
I think that's a good topic, which is, you know, you have control of when you do the migration. One model is to do it when the application starts up, right? You can do it separately. You can just deploy the application and keep the migration scripts not being run as part of that and run the migration scripts explicitly yourself. And then it depends on how you want to handle those cases. You can have the app built so that it can be resilient to different types of schema, and then you can, you know, run it separately. You can take the app down for a minute if you want to do it. There's a bunch of different trade-offs as part of it. It depends on the level of sophistication that you want to bring to your application.
Yep. So to kind of round this out, I think that's everything I need. Let's go ahead and build this. We can also check on our other build here really quickly. So there's our build request, view build details. It looks like it's in the publishing process. That's good. Our unit tests ran. You'll notice that every time I compile, my unit tests are running in my IDE. It's called the Continuous Test Runner, and it is a really great new feature. So we should be able to pull up our application here. Hold on a second. Let's try again. Value, priority. Let's check my JavaScript here. Priority. What the world did I do wrong? We need the sad trombone going on. Great. So I got a JavaScript error. Now I got to figure out what that is.
So basically, your new feature is broken, right?
It is broken. So I'm gonna have to figure out how to.
I think you need some new test cases because your tests all look
green. I do.
I need some
test cases for my UI view model here.
I mean, it would be a little bit message defeating, but you could deploy the broken version so we could see the continuous delivery works.
Yeah. Reference area priority, root priorities, value priority. It's undefined. Well, something is not.
Anybody in the audience? Did you see it?
Priority. Did I spell everything right? Priority. I don't know. All right. Well, let's go check on our other deployment here real quick. So wait, let our website spin up. Should be setting up the database. Checking our build definition. That looks good. And
Wait for it.
Come on. For some reason our website has decided not to come up. And this is the first time this has happened when I've done this demo. This is sad.
I will vouch. I have watched him do it a few
it's
times.
Like 100 times. And it's, I don't know what's going on. All right. Well,
hit.
Give me a second. Jamie, talk about the other stuff, and we figure out what's going on here.
Okay, well, as you can see, quality is kind of important in this conversation. Isn't that right, Chris?
It is, yes.
So, you know, one nice thing, though, about what Chris is doing is that he was only trying to add a small feature, right? So he added a small feature, and he found the problem right away, which was good. And actually, one of the points, because I do want to talk a little bit about bubbling up from the technology, which isn't working very well, kind of the principle side of things. You know, one of the things you want to keep in mind when you're doing this is small iterations are much better than large iterations, right? If you're trying to push out very large changes, you're much more likely to have quality problems. It's going to be much more likely, if you do have a problem, to unwind that problem. The nice thing about putting small things out, if something went wrong, it may not be that massive of a bug, but you can go and fix it. Like, one of the things that we found from the TFS side of things that's been a real culture shift for us is...
This appears to be a network problem, by the way.
Oh, sure. Uh-huh.
Well, it is. I can't even talk to the web server. I'm not sure what's going on here.
I'm not sure that qualifies.
Actually, a gateway or proxy.
Did you hear...
That's not good. No, this definitely looks to be network related. Like, I can't hit any websites now.
Well, here, I have a network
connection. Oh, there it goes. It's back. Yay.
What about the other problem, Chris? Was that the network too?
Well, no, that one's me. I don't know what's going on. I can't spell apparently. So anyway, there's my task list. So this is the first version. So that seems to be working. All right, let's check. Trust the gods. All right, so there's the first version of my application deployed. Give me a second to see if I can figure out what's going on with this other one.
I have a suggestion for you. As one of the version control PMs, we have a feature called undo. So,
but undo is not going to help me here because I haven't done yet.
Just undo everything you've just done, right? Like, I'm just saying, you undo everything in your workspace. You don't have to, see what I'm saying?
And then the feature's not there, so if I undo, it's not going to help the problem here.
All right, fine, be difficult. Okay. So I'm going to switch over to slides so Chris can have some privacy. And if he gets it figured out in the next few minutes, we'll switch back and see if we can get that demo working. So we were talking about doing small iterations so that when we find problems, they're easy to fix. So culture change. So one of the things that we've been going through in this process, ourselves and TFS, is, when was the last, we're about to ship to 2012. Right? When was the last time we shipped? 2010, effectively over 2 years ago. This is the typical release cycle that we do at Microsoft. They're very large releases. And it may not always seem like it to you guys, but we actually do spend a lot of time trying to make the quality very high, trying to get all of the bugs fixed. And the notion of putting out a build that and shipping without having tested it in every different configuration and every different matrix that's kind of built into our psyche. And with taking TFS and moving it to a hosted service and getting it set up so that we can do this type of continuous delivery scenario, it's been a bit of that shift. In terms of what we do for our production site, we don't, obviously if a developer changes something, it doesn't show up in production, 2 minutes later, but we ship every 3 weeks. So we do 3 week sprints. And at the end of the sprint, then we have kind of a week where we go through and make sure that build is all good, and then we push it up to the hosted service. And that's the current rate that we're at. We were slower before, and we're trying to get faster, right? We're trying to reduce the cycle time it takes from when the dev makes a change to getting it up. And part of what we had to go through was the notion of if we do things in a small enough increment and things go wrong, it's easy for us to go fix it. And it means that we can be okay with trusting that we've built a high-quality product and the test caught it, and if we missed a little something, it'll be easy to fix because we did it in small iterations. We can also do this because, quality is job one. We have about, for TFS itself, what do you think, Chris, about 60 developers? Okay, I don't want to bother you. Keep going.
Yeah, don't bother me.
We have about 60 developers that work on the core. You sure?
It was a browser cache issue. It was caching the wrong version of the JavaScript file.
Sure was, Chris.
It was.
Just deploy.
Show
we'll
you.
See if it will just hit deploy. We'll see if it's done. And what was I? So we have about 60 developers. We have tons of tests. Because we focus on quality, it's the only way it makes it work. If we didn't do that, then we would be in one of those. We'd be in that mode where every 3 weeks we get a good build, and it wouldn't be possible. So that also goes to the design and implementation. You have to think about design, but you don't want to be paralyzed by it. Do just enough, increment your design, use your tests as much as possible to drive what you need to do from a design work perspective. So that's pretty much the talk. Chris is going to come back with this in a second, so let me give you a few references.
Go ahead, go back. It's checking in now.
You ready? You ready?
Well, hold on. So it's checking in.
Okay.
So I did fix the problem. The problem was a browser cache.
Okay. So he clicked check in. So it's building and deploying. So
yeah,
I'm going to.
So we have. Yeah. So it's now.
So I'm going to get through this in under 2 minutes, and we're going to go back before it's done. So,
all right.
We talked about a lot of different things. So if you want to find out more about the ops side of DevOps, 363, Vishal's got a talk right after this. I talked about one method of deployment to Azure with WebDeploy. There's actually a bunch of them. Actually, Vishal is doing that talk. Victor's doing the DevOps talk after this. Testing untestable code, going deeper into the test stuff that Chris was going through. Peter's doing that talk. I think most of these are still upcoming. There may be one or two that was already done. If so, just there's videos to go watch for everything. Continuous delivery of Windows Azure Cloud apps. So if you want to do the same type of thing we're doing here, but with the traditional Azure type of applications, you can do that too, and there's a talk on that. If you want to find more about the web API and HTTP services we started with, talk on that. Websites, that whole the lightweight web model that I talked about from Windows Azure, there's a talk on that. And then finally, just diving into the entity framework and data scenarios here, there's a good talk on that. So there is a, we are down at the demo booth if you want to check this stuff out. But like I said, all you need is Visual Studio and then these two hosted services that take almost no time to get signed up with themselves. So you can play with all this stuff yourself. And then Chris and I will be hanging around after here to answer questions and down at the DevTool track bench for a while afterwards for any more questions. So let's go back real quick. Grand finale.
So we are, we're still building. So we're compiling running tests. We could take a look. We did see the other one run, right? Yeah, so that's good. Yep. We can verify that. So if we look at the URL here, we'll do a quick win plus, right? So we have TechEd CD5, right? We want to make sure that, yep, that is the same website. When minus that, it is actually running.
Show the Azure website. Deployments.
Oh, yeah. So we can see in progress. So now we're on the Azure website. We actually see there's a deployment in progress. And this is querying information from TFS. There's a build running. It's currently deploying. I can click on this log and actually go to the web view of my build log and see what's going on. So MS Deploy is currently running.
And that red icon is a stop.
This is
not
a stop,
a,
not a failed
icon,
build.
Right? Okay, good.
This is a UX
issue. I think we put that there just to cause panic for people.
Yep. So if we get through MS Deploy here, hopefully, we should be in good shape. And there we go. So now we have our priorities. Adding more tasks. So we'll add that. We can set the priority.
We have
save it.
And we did that. We ran,
this, it.
Ran the table migration.
Yeah,
right?
The table migration ran. Data saving. So we went from build an app, deployed it from the cloud to the cloud, changed the app, deployed it from the cloud to the cloud, ran all our tests in an hour and 12 minutes.
So. All right, thank you very much. And we have used all our question time, so we'll be hanging around here if you've got any more. Talk to you guys later.
Thank you.